Chapter 1. Mismanaging a Pandemic. My friend, have you ever been in a quarantine city? Then you cannot realize what you are asking me to do. To place such a curse on San Francisco would be worse than 100 fires and earthquakes, and I love this city too well to do her such a frightful hurt. Rupert Blue, Public Health Service officer in charge of dealing with the 1907 plague outbreak. Blue subsequently served as 4th Surgeon General of the U.S. and President of the American Medical Association. 1. Arbitrary Decrees, Science-Free Medicine. Dr. Fauci's strategy for managing the COVID-19 pandemic was to suppress viral spread by mandatory masking, social distancing, quarantining the healthy, also known as lockdowns, while instructing COVID patients to return home and do nothing, receive no treatment whatsoever, until difficulties breathing sent them back to the hospital to submit to intravenous remdesivir and ventilation. This approach to ending an infectious disease contagion had no public health precedent and anemic scientific support. Predictably, it was grossly ineffective. America racked up the world's highest body counts. Medicines were available against COVID, inexpensive, safe medicines that would have prevented hundreds of thousands of hospitalizations and saved as many lives if only we'd used them in this country. But Dr. Fauci and his pharma collaborators deliberately suppressed those treatments in service to their single-minded objective, making America await salvation from their novel multi-billion-dollar vaccines. Americans' native idealism will make them reluctant to believe that their government's COVID policies were so grotesquely ill-conceived, so unfounded in science, so tethered to financial interests, that they caused hundreds of thousands of wholly unnecessary deaths. But as you will hear, the evidence speaks for itself. Peer-reviewed science offered anemic, if any, support for masking, quarantines, and social distancing, and Dr. Fauci offered no citations or justifications to support his diktats. Both common sense and the weight of scientific evidence suggest that all these strategies, and unquestionably shutting down the global economy, caused far more injuries and deaths than they averted. Dr. Fauci was clearly aware that his mask decrees were contrary to overwhelming science. In July 2020, after switching course to recommend national mask mandates, Dr. Fauci told Nora O'Donnell with InStyle magazine that his earlier dismissal of mask efficacy was correct in the context of the time in which I said it, and that he intended to prevent a consumer run on masks that might jeopardize their availability for frontline responders. But Dr. Fauci's emails reveal that he was giving the same advice privately. Moreover, his detailed explanations to the public and to high-level health regulators indicate he genuinely believed that ordinary masks had little to no efficacy against viral infection. In a February 5, 2020 email, for example, he advised his putative former boss, President Obama's Health and Human Services Secretary Sylvia Burwell, on the futility of masking the healthy. On February 17, he invoked the same rationale in an interview with USA Today. A mask is much more appropriate for someone who is infected and you're trying to prevent them from infecting other people than it is in protecting you against infection. If you look at the masks that you buy in a drugstore, the leakage around that doesn't really do much to protect you. Now, in the United States, there is absolutely no reason whatsoever to wear a mask. During a January 28th speech to HHS regulators, he explained the fruitlessness of masking asymptomatic people. The one thing historically people need to realize, that even if there is some asymptomatic transmission, in all the history of respiratory-borne viruses of any type, asymptomatic transmission has never been the driver of outbreaks. The driver of outbreaks is always a symptomatic person. Even if there's a rare asymptomatic person that might transmit, an epidemic is not driven by asymptomatic carriers. Consistent with Dr. Fauci's earlier statements, the peer-reviewed scientific literature has steadfastly refused to support masking the healthy as an effective barrier to viral spread, and Dr. Fauci offered a citation to justify his change of heart. A December 2020 comprehensive study of 10 million Wuhan residents confirmed Fauci's January 28, 2020 assertion that asymptomatic transmission of COVID-19 is infinitesimally rare. Furthermore, some 52 studies, all available on NIH's website, find that ordinary masking, using less than an N95 respirator, doesn't reduce viral infection rates, even, surprisingly, in institutional settings like hospitals and surgical theaters. Moreover, some 25 additional studies attribute to masking a grim retinue of harms, including respiratory and immune system illnesses, as well as dermatological, dental, gastrointestinal, and psychological injuries. 14 of these studies are randomized, peer-reviewed placebo studies. There is no well-constructed study that persuasively suggests masks have convincing efficacy against COVID-19 that would justify accepting the harms associated with masks. Finally, retrospective studies on Dr. Fauci's mask mandates confirm that they were bootless. Regional analysis in the United States does not show that mask mandates had any effect on case rates, despite 93% compliance. Moreover, according to CDC data, 85% of people who contracted COVID-19 reported wearing a mask, according to Guten Tag. Dr. Fauci observed in March 2020 that a mask's only real efficacy may be in making people feel a little better. Perhaps he recognized that what masking lacked in efficacy against contagion, it compensated for with powerful psychological effects. These symbolic powers demonstrated strategic benefits for the larger enterprise of encouraging public compliance with draconian medical mandates. Dr. Fauci's switch to endorsing masks after first recommending against them came at a time of increasing political polarization, and masks quickly became important tribal badges, signals of rectitude for those who embraced Dr. Fauci, and the stigmata of blind obedience to undeserving authority among those who balked. Moreover, masking, by amplifying everyone's fear, helped inoculate the public against critical thinking. By serving as persistent reminders that each of our fellow citizens was a potentially dangerous and germ-infected threat to us, masks increased social isolation and fostered divisions and fractionalization, thereby impeding organized political resistance. The impact of masking on the national psyche reminded me of the subtle contribution of the duck and cover drills of my youth, drills that sustained and cemented the militaristic ideology of the Cold War. Those futile exercises reinforced what my uncle John F. Kennedy's Defense Secretary Robert McNamara called national mass psychosis. By suggesting to Americans that full-scale nuclear war was possible, but also survivable, ruinous investments in that project were justified. For the government and mandarins of the military-industrial complex, this absurd narrative yielded trillions in appropriations. Social distancing mandates also rested on a dubious scientific footing. In September 2021, former FDA Commissioner Dr. Scott Gottlieb admitted that the 6-foot distancing rule that Dr. Fauci and his HHS colleagues imposed upon Americans was arbitrary and not, after all, science-backed. The process for making that policy choice, Gottlieb continued, is a perfect example of the lack of rigor around how CDC made recommendations. Finally, the lockdowns of the healthy were so unprecedented that WHO's official pandemic protocols recommended against them. Some WHO officials were passionate on the topic. Among them, Professor David Nabarro, senior envoy on COVID-19, a position reporting to the Director General. On October 8, 2020, he said, "We in the World Health Organization do not advocate lockdowns as a primary means of controlling this virus. We may well have a doubling of world poverty by next year. We'll have at least a doubling of child malnutrition because children are not getting meals at school and their parents and poor families are not able to afford it. This is a terrible, ghastly, global catastrophe, actually, and so we really do appeal to all world leaders. Stop using lockdown as your primary control method. Lockdowns just have one consequence that you must never, ever belittle, and that is making poor people an awful lot poorer." As discussed, Dr. Fauci and other officials made no inquiry or claims as to whether lockdowns would cause more harm and death than they averted. Subsequent studies have strongly suggested that lockdowns had no impact in reducing infection rates. There is no convincing difference in COVID infections and deaths between laissez-faire jurisdictions and those that enforced rigid lockdowns and masks. Noble lies and bad data. Dr. Fauci's mask deceptions were among several noble lies that his critics complained reveal a manipulative and deceptive disposition, undesirable in an even-handed public health official. Dr. Fauci explained to the New York Times that he had upgraded his estimate of the vaccine coverage needed to ensure herd immunity from 70% in March to 80 to 90% in September, not based on science, but rather in response to polling that indicated rising rates of vaccine acceptance. He regularly expressed his belief that post-infection immunity was highly likely, with occasional waffling on this topic, although he took the public position that natural immunity did not contribute to protecting the population. He supported COVID jabs for previously infected Americans, defying overwhelming scientific evidence that post-COVID inoculations were both unnecessary and dangerous. Under questioning on September 9, 2021, Dr. Fauci conceded he could cite no scientific justification for this policy. In September 2021, in a statement justifying COVID vaccine mandates to school children, Dr. Fauci dreamily recounted his own grade school measles and mumps vaccines, an unlikely memory, since those vaccines weren't available until 1963. In 1967, and Dr. Fauci attended grade school in the 1940s. Dr. Fauci's little perjuries about masks, measles, mumps, herd immunity, and natural immunity attest to his dismaying willingness to manipulate facts to serve a political agenda. If the COVID-19 pandemic has revealed anything, it is that public health officials have based their many calamitous directives for managing COVID-19 on vacillating and science-free beliefs about masks, lockdowns, infection, and fatality rates, asymptomatic transmission, and vaccine safety and efficacy, which took every direction and sowed confusion, division, and polarization among the public and medical experts. Dr. Fauci's libertine approach to facts may have contributed to what, for me, was the most troubling and infuriating feature of all the public health responses to COVID: the blatant and relentless manipulation of data to serve the vaccine agenda became the apogee of a year of stunning regulatory malpractice. high quality and transparent data, clearly documented, timely rendered, and publicly available are the sine qua non of competent public health management. During a pandemic, reliable and comprehensive data are critical for determining the behavior of the pathogen, identifying vulnerable populations, rapidly measuring the effectiveness of interventions, mobilizing the medical community around cutting-edge disease management, and inspiring cooperation from the public. The shockingly low quality of virtually all relevant data pertinent to COVID-19, and the quackery, the obfuscation, the cherry-picking and blatant perversion would have scandalized, offended, and humiliated every prior generation of American public health officials. Too often, Dr. Fauci was at the center of these systemic deceptions. The mistakes were always in the same direction, inflating the risks of coronavirus and the safety and efficacy of vaccines in order to stoke public fear of COVID and provoke mass compliance. The excuses for his mistakes range from blaming the public, now blaming the unvaccinated, blaming politics, and explaining his gyrations by saying, "You've got to evolve with the science." At the outset of the pandemic, Dr. Fauci used wildly inaccurate modeling that overestimated U.S. deaths by 525%. Scammer and pandemic fabricator Neil Ferguson of Imperial College London was their author, with funding from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation of $148.8 million. Dr. Fauci used this model as justification for his lockdowns. Dr. Fauci acquiesced to CDC's selective protocol changes for completing death certificates in a way that inflated the claimed deaths from COVID and thus inflated its infection mortality rate. CDC later admitted that only 6% of COVID deaths occurred in entirely healthy individuals. The remaining 94% suffered from an average of 3.8 potentially fatal comorbidities. Regulators misused PCR tests that CDC belatedly admitted in August 2021 were incapable of distinguishing COVID from other viral illnesses. Dr. Fauci tolerated their use at inappropriately high amplitudes of 37 and up to 45, even though Fauci had told Vince Roccaniello that tests employing cycle thresholds of 35 and above were very unlikely to indicate the presence of live virus that could replicate. In July 2020, Fauci remarked that at these levels, a positive result is just dead nucleotides, period, yet did nothing to modify testing so it might be more accurate. As America's COVID czar, Dr. Fauci never complained about CDC's decision to skip autopsies from deaths attributed to vaccines. This practice allowed CDC to persistently claim that all deaths following vaccination were unrelated to vaccination. CDC also refused to conduct follow-up medical inquiries among people claiming vaccine injuries. Inspired by rich incentives to classify every patient as a COVID-19 victim, Medicare paid hospitals $39,000 per ventilator when treating COVID-19. And only $13,000 for garden variety respiratory infections. Hospitals contributed to the deception. Once more, Dr. Fauci winked at the fraud. Dr. Fauci's refusal to fix the HHS's notoriously dysfunctional Vaccine Injury Surveillance System, VAERS, constituted inexcusable negligence. HHS's own studies indicate that VAERS may be understating vaccine injuries by over 99%. The public never received facts about infection fatality rates or age-stratified risks for COVID with the kind of clarity that might have allowed them and their physicians to make evidence-based personal risk assessments. Instead, federal officials relied on vagueness and deception to recklessly overestimate the dangers from COVID in every age group. All of these deceptions riddled virtually every mainstream media report, particularly those by CNN and the New York Times, leaving the public with a vastly inflated and cataclysmically inaccurate impression of its lethality. Public surveys showed that just as Fox News audiences were shockingly misinformed following the 9/11 bombings, CNN viewers and New York Times readers were catastrophically misinformed about the facts of COVID-19 during 2020. Successive Gallup polling showed that the average Democrat believed that 50% of COVID infections resulted in hospitalizations. The real number was less than 1%. Trust the experts. Instead of demanding blue ribbon safety science and encouraging honest, open, and responsible debate on the science, badly compromised government health officials charged with managing the COVID-19 pandemic collaborated with mainstream and social media to shut down discussion on key public health questions. They silenced doctors who offered any early treatments that might compete with vaccines, or who refused to pledge unquestioning faith in zero liability, shoddily tested experimental vaccines. The chaotic and confusing data collection and interpretation allowed regulators to justify their arbitrary diktats under the cloak of scientific consensus. Instead of citing scientific studies or clear data to justify mandates for masks, lockdowns, and vaccines, our medical rulers cited Dr. Fauci, or WHO, CDC, FDA, and NIH, captive agencies, to legitimize the medical technocracy's assumption of dangerous new powers. Dr. Fauci's aficionados, including President Biden and the cable and network news anchors, counseled Americans to trust the experts. Such advice is both anti-democratic and anti-science. Science is dynamic. Experts frequently differ on scientific questions, and their opinions can vary in accordance with and demands of politics, powers, and financial self-interest. Nearly every lawsuit I have ever litigated pitted highly credentialed experts from opposite sides against each other, with all of them swearing under oath to diametrically antithetical positions based on the same set of facts. Telling people to trust the experts is either naive or manipulative, or both. All of Dr. Fauci's intrusive mandates and his deceptive use of data tended to stoke fear and amplify public desperation for the anticipated arrival of vaccines that would transfer billions of dollars from taxpayers to pharmaceutical executives and shareholders. Some of America's most accomplished scientists, and the physicians leading the battle against COVID in the trenches, came to believe that Anthony Fauci's do-or-die obsession with novel mRNA vaccines and Gilead's expensive patented antiviral remdesivir prompted him to ignore or even suppress effective early treatments, causing hundreds of thousands of unnecessary deaths while also prolonging the pandemic. Fortifying immune systems. I was struck during COVID-19's early months that America's doctor, apparently preoccupied with his single vaccine solution, did little in the way of telling Americans how to bolster their immune response. He never took time during his daily White House briefings from March to May 2020 to instruct Americans to avoid tobacco. Smoking and e-cigarettes, vaping, double death rates from COVID. To get plenty of sunlight and to maintain adequate vitamin D levels. Nearly 60% of patients with COVID-19 were vitamin D deficient upon hospitalization, with men in the advanced stages of COVID-19 pneumonia showing the greatest deficit. Or to diet, exercise, and lose weight. 78% of Americans hospitalized for COVID-19 were overweight or obese. Quite the contrary, Dr. Fauci's lockdowns caused Americans to gain an average of 2 pounds per month and to reduce their daily steps by 27%. He didn't recommend avoiding sugar and soft drinks, processed foods, and chemical residues, all of which amplify inflammation, compromise immune response, and disrupt the gut biome, which governs the immune system. During the centuries that science has fruitlessly sought remedies against coronavirus, aka the common cold, only zinc has repeatedly proven its efficacy in peer-reviewed studies. Zinc impedes viral replication, prophylaxing against colds and abbreviating their duration. The groaning shelves that commercial pharmacies devote to zinc-based cold remedies attest to its extraordinary efficacy. Yet Anthony Fauci never advised Americans to increase zinc uptake following exposure to infection. Dr. Fauci's neglect of natural immune response was consistent with the pervasive hostility towards any non-vaccine intervention that characterized the federal regulatory gestalt. On April 30, 2021, Canadian Ontario College of Physicians and Surgeons threatened to de-license any doctor who prescribed non-vaccine health strategies, including vitamin D. They are trying to erase any notion of natural immunity, says Canadian vaccine researcher Dr. Jessica Rose, PhD, MSc, BSc. Pretty soon, the incessant lies and propaganda will have successfully instilled in the masses that the only hope for staying alive is via injection, pill popping, so in sum, no natural immunity. In a podcast interview on October 1, 2021, Washington Post reporter Ashley Fetters Malloy pretended to expose misinformation about COVID-19 by broadcasting misinformation. There's a pervasive idea that your body and your immune system can be healthy enough to ward off COVID-19, which, of course, we know it's a novel coronavirus. No one's body can. No one's body is healthy enough to recognize and just totally ward this off without a vaccine. Clearly, this is false information. Throughout 2020, before vaccines were available, some 99.9% of people's natural immune systems protected their owners from severe illness and death. The CDC and World Health Organization, indeed all global health authorities, have recognized that healthy people with healthy immune systems bear minimal risk from COVID. Indeed, many people, according to our health authorities, have an immune response sufficient that they don't even know they have COVID. Malloy's pronouncement that humans cannot fight off COVID-19 without a vaccine is misinformation in its purest form. Instead of urging calm and telling us, as FDR did during the depths of the Depression, that we have nothing to fear but fear itself, all of Dr. Fauci's prescriptions and communications seemed intended to maximize stress and trauma. Enforced isolation, mandated masking, business closures, evictions and bankruptcies, lockdowns, and separating children from parents and parents from grandparents. We now know that fear, stress, and trauma wreak havoc on our immune systems. Early treatment. His critics argue that Dr. Fauci's slow the spread, flatten the curve, wait for the jab strategy, all in support of a long-term bet on unproven vaccines, represented a profound and unprecedented departure from accepted public health practice. But most troubling were Dr. Fauci's policies of ignoring and outright suppressing the early treatment of infected patients who were often terrified. The best practices for defeating an infectious disease epidemic, says Yale epidemiologist Harvey Riche, dictate that you quarantine and treat the sick, protect the most vulnerable, and aggressively develop repurposed therapeutic drugs, and use early treatment protocols to avoid hospitalizations. Riche is one of the leading global authorities in clinical treatment protocols. He is the editor of two high gravitas journals and the author of over 350 peer-reviewed publications. Other researchers have cited those studies over 44,000 times. Riche points out a hard truth that should have informed our COVID control strategy. Unless you are an island nation prepared to shut out the world, you can't stop a global viral pandemic, but you can make it less deadly. Our objective should have been to devise treatments that would reduce hospitalization and death. We could have easily defanged COVID-19 so that it was less lethal than a seasonal flu. We could have done this very quickly. We could have saved hundreds of thousands of lives. Dr. Peter McCullough concurs. Once a highly transmissible virus like COVID has a beachhead in a population, it is inevitable that it will spread to every individual who lacks immunity. You can slow the spread, but you cannot prevent it, any more than you can prevent the tide from rising. McCullough was an internist and cardiologist on staff at the Baylor University Medical Center and the Baylor Heart and Vascular Hospital in Dallas, Texas. His 600 peer-reviewed articles in the National Library of Medicine make McCullough the most published physician in history in the field of kidney disease related to heart disease, a lethal sequela of COVID-19. Before COVID-19, he was editor of two major journals. His recent publications include over 40 on COVID-19, including two landmark studies on critical care of the disease. His two breakthrough papers on the early treatment of COVID-19 in the American Journal of Medicine and reviews in cardiovascular medicine in 2020 are by far the most downloaded documents on the subject. I've had COVID-19 myself with pulmonary involvement, he told me. My wife has had it. On my wife's side of the family, we've had a fatality. I believe I have as much or more medical authority to give my opinion as anybody in the world. McCullough observes that we could have dramatically reduced COVID fatalities and hospitalizations using early treatment protocols and repurposed drugs including ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine and many, many others. Dr. McCullough has treated some 2,000 COVID patients with these therapies. McCullough points out that hundreds of peer-reviewed studies now show that early treatment could have averted some 80% of deaths attributed to COVID. The strategy from the outset should have been implementing protocols to stop hospitalizations through early treatment of Americans who tested positive for COVID but were still asymptomatic. If we had done that, we could have pushed case fatality rates below those we see with seasonal flu and ended the bottlenecks in our hospitals. We should have rapidly deployed off-the-shelf medications with proven safety records and subjected them to rigorous risk-benefit decision-making, McCullough continues. Using repurposed drugs, we could have ended this pandemic by May 2020 and saved 500,000 American lives. But for Dr. Fauci's hard-headed tunnel vision on new vaccines and remdesivir. Pulmonary and critical care specialist Dr. Pierre Corey agrees with McCullough's estimate. The efficacy of some of these drugs as prophylaxis is almost miraculous, plus early intervention in the week after exposure stops viral replication and prevents development of cytokine storm and entrance into the pulmonary phase, says Dr. Corey. We could have stopped the pandemic in its tracks in the spring of 2020. Riche, McCullough, and Corey are among the large chorus of experts, including Nobel laureate Luc Montagnier, who argue that by treating infected patients at home during the early stages of the illness, we could have averted cataclysmic lockdowns and found medicine resources for protecting vulnerable populations while encouraging the spread of the disease in age groups with extremely low risk in order to achieve permanent herd immunity. They point out that natural immunity in all known cases is superior to vaccine-induced immunity being both more durable, it often lasts a lifetime, and broader spectrum, meaning it provides a shield against subsequent variants. Vaccinating citizens with natural immunity should never have been our public health policy, says Dr. Corey. Dr. Fauci's strategy committed hundreds of billions of societal resources on a high-risk gambit to develop novel technology vaccines, and virtually nothing toward developing repurposed medications that are effective against COVID. That strategy kept the medical treatment on hold globally for an entire year as a readily treatable respiratory virus ravaged populations, says Corey. It is absolutely shocking that he recommended no outpatient care, not even vitamin D, despite the fact he takes it himself, and much of the country is vitamin D deficient. Dr. Corey is president of Frontline COVID-19 Critical Care Alliance, a former associate professor and medical director of the Trauma and Life Support Center at the University of Wisconsin Medical School Hospital, and the Critical Care Service Chief at Aurora St. Luke's Medical Center in Milwaukee. His milestone work on critical care ultrasonography won him the British Medical Association's President's Choice Award in 2015. Riche, McCullough, and Corey are also among the hundreds of scientists and physicians who expressed shock that Dr. Fauci made no effort to identify repurposed medicines. Says Corey, "I find it appalling that there was no consultation process with treating physicians. Medicine is about consultation. You had Birx, Fauci, and Redfield doing press conferences every day and handing down these arbitrary diktats, and not one of them ever treated a COVID patient or worked in an emergency room or ICU. They knew nothing." As I watched the White House task force on TV, recalls Dr. McCullough, no one even said that hospitalizations and deaths were the bad outcome of COVID-19, and that they were going to put together a team of doctors to identify protocols and therapeutics to stop these hospitalizations and deaths. Dr. McCullough argues that, as COVID czar, Dr. Fauci should have created an international communications network linking the world's 11 million frontline doctors to gather real-time tips, innovative safety protocols, and to develop the best prophylactic and early treatment practices. He should have created hotlines and dedicated websites for medical professionals to call in with treatment questions and to consult, collect, catalog, and propagate the latest innovations for prophylaxing vulnerable and exposed individuals and treating early infections, so as to avert hospitalizations. Dr. Corey agrees. The outcome we should have been trying to prevent is hospitalizations. You don't just sit around and wait for an infected patient to become ill. Dr. Fauci's treatment strategies all began once all these under-medicated patients were hospitalized. By that time, it was too late for many of them. It was insane. It was perverse. It was unethical. Dr. McCullough says that Dr. Fauci should have created treatment centers for ambulatory patients and field clinics specializing in treating asymptomatic or early-stage COVID. He should have been encouraging doctors to use satellite clinics to conduct small outpatient clinical trials to quickly identify the most effective protocols, drugs, and therapeutics. Professor Riche concurs. We should have deployed teams of doctors all over the world, doing short-term clinical trials and testing promising drugs and reporting successful protocols. The endpoints were obvious, preventing hospitalizations and deaths. In addition to rapidly developing and continuously updating protocols and remedies, McCullough and Corey say that the government failed to perform the essential duty of a public health regulator during modern pandemics, to publish the best early treatment protocols on NIH's website, and then establish communication lines call centers to foster consultation and information sharing, and web pages to share, broadcast, and update the latest remedies and continually escalate public knowledge about the most successful strategies. Dr. McCullough adds, "We should have created information and communication centers where treating physicians and hospitals could get round-the-clock, up-to-date bulletins with data. Instead, doctors who wanted to provide their infected patients with early treatment were out of luck." Nursing homes and quarantine facilities. Dr. Riche says that in addition to developing early treatment protocols, public health officials should have made sure that elderly patients remained in quarantine hospitals until no longer contagious. "It's obvious that we should have had quarantine facilities so we wouldn't be sending infected patients to crowded nursing homes. Instead, we should have housed them in safe facilities and protected them with cutting-edge care." Riche points out that taxpayers spent $660 million building field hospitals across the country. Democratic Governor Andrew Cuomo and other Democratic governors kept these facilities empty to maintain bed inventories in anticipation of the flood of patients inaccurately predicted by the fear-mongering models, ginned up by two Gates-funded organizations, IMHE and Royal College of London, and then anointed as gospel by Dr. Fauci, seemingly as part of the crusade to generate public panic. With those quarantine centers standing empty, those governors sent infected elderly back to crowded nursing homes, where they spread the disease to the most vulnerable population with lethal effect. Riche points out that half the deaths in New York and one-third nationally were among elder care facility residents. Dr. Fauci made another inexplicable policy choice of not supplying the nursing homes with monoclonal antibodies, where they might have saved thousands of lives. "With Operation Warp Speed, we had monoclonal antibodies that were high-tech and fully FDA-approved by November 2020, long before the vaccines," says Dr. McCullough. "Monoclonal antibodies work great, but they're not suitable for outpatients because they are administered IV. It's therefore perfect for nursing homes. About one-third of COVID deaths occurred in the nursing homes and ALFs across the U.S. during the pandemic." Dr. Fauci should have equipped both nursing homes and quarantine hospitals with monoclonal antibodies, said Riche. Instead, he obstructed these institutions from administering that medicine. "It was a kind of staggering, savage act of malpractice and negligence to deny this remedy to elder care facilities at a time when the elderly were dying at a rate of 10,000 per week. You need, in short, to do the opposite of everything they did. It's difficult to identify anything they did that was right," says McCullough. Independent doctors into the breach. Early in the pandemic, Corey and his mentor, Dr. Paul Merrick, professor of medicine and chief of division of pulmonary and critical care medicine at Eastern Virginia Medical School, began assembling the world's most highly published and accomplished critical care specialists to rapidly develop functional COVID treatments. Each of the core five founders of FLCCC is globally renowned for having made significant pre-COVID contributions to the science of critical care and pulmonary illnesses. Some 1,693 frontline physicians globally now belong to their alliance. Early in the pandemic, these doctors stepped into the breach left by the government agencies and pandemic centers and began coordinating the development of early treatments with repurposed drugs. They quickly proved that they could drastically reduce COVID's lethality. Instead of winning applause as medical healers, their success at treating COVID made them enemies of the state. Long before he heard of Pierre Corey or FLCCC, Dr. Peter McCullough reached the same conclusions about the futility and immorality of the federal effort and felt the same indignation and determination to change things. "By April and May, I noticed a disturbing trend," recalls McCullough. "The trend was no effort to treat patients who are infected with COVID-19 at home or in nursing homes. and it almost seemed as if patients were intentionally not being treated, allowed to sit at home and get to the point where they couldn't breathe and then be admitted to the hospital. Dr. Fauci adopted this unprecedented protocol of telling doctors to let patients diagnosed with a positive COVID test go home untreated, leaving them in terror and spreading the disease until breathing difficulties forced their return to hospitals. There they faced two deadly remedies, remdesivir and ventilators. I experienced my own personal frustrations with this bewildering policy. When in December 2020, I asked my 93-year-old mother's physician to describe her treatment plan if she got a positive PCR, he told me, "There is really nothing we can do unless she starts having trouble breathing. Then we will send her up to Mass General for ventilation." When I asked him about using ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine, he shrugged his shoulders. He had never heard of their use in COVID patients. "There is no early treatment for COVID," he assured me. Dr. Fauci's choice to deny infected Americans early treatment was not just a bad public health strategy. It was, McCullough avows, cruelty at a population level. Says McCullough, "Never in history have doctors deliberately treated patients with this kind of barbarism." I told myself, "I am not going to tolerate that in my practice or on a national level or worldwide," Dr. McCullough told me. Realizing that COVID had to be fought on multiple fronts, McCullough began contacting physicians in other nations who were reporting success against the disease, including doctors in Italy, Greece, Canada, across Europe, and in Bangladesh and South Africa. McCullough continues, "If this had been any other form of pneumonia, a respiratory illness, or any other infectious illness in the human body, we know that if we start early, we can actually treat much more easily than wait until patients are very sick." McCullough says that the rule holds true for COVID-19. "We learned quickly that it takes about 2 weeks for someone infected with COVID to get sick enough at home to require hospitalization." Frontline clinical doctors quickly recognized that the disease was operating through multiple pathways, each requiring their own treatment protocol. There were three major parts of the illness, says McCullough. One, the virus was replicating for as long as 2 weeks. Two, there was incredible inflammation in the body. And three, that was followed by blood clotting. He adds, "By April 2020, most doctors understood a single drug was not going to be enough to treat this illness. We had to use drugs in combination." "We quickly developed three principles," says McCullough. His three-step protocol was as follows. Use medications to slow down the virus. Use medications to attenuate or reduce inflammation. Address blood clotting. McCullough and his global partners quickly identified a pharmacopoeia of off-the-shelf treatments demonstrating extraordinary efficacy against each stage of COVID when administered early in the course of the disease. McCullough chronicles the rapid pace with which frontline doctors uncovered rich apothecaries of effective COVID remedies. HHS's early studies supported hydroxychloroquine's efficacy against coronavirus since 2005, and by March 2020, doctors from New York to Asia were using it against COVID with extraordinary effect. That month, McCullough and other physicians at his medical center organized with the FDA one of the first prophylactic protocols using hydroxychloroquine. "We had terrific data on ivermectin from the medical teams in Bangladesh and elsewhere by early summer 2020. So now we had two cheap generics." McCullough and his growing team of 50-plus frontline doctors discovered that while HCQ and IVM work well against COVID, adding other medications boosts outcomes drastically. These included azithromycin or doxycycline, zinc, vitamin D, Celebrex, bromhexine, NAC, IV vitamin C, and quercetin. McCullough's team realized that, like hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin, quercetin, that ubiquitous health store nutraceutical, is an ionophore, meaning that it facilitates zinc uptake in the cells, destroying the capacity of coronavirus to replicate. The Canadians came on with colchicine in a high-quality trial based on an initial Greek trial, McCullough continued. We learned more from experts at UCLA and elsewhere with respect to blood clotting and the need for aspirin and blood thinners. We got early approval for monoclonal antibodies. It was later learned that both fluvoxamine and famotidine could play roles in multi-drug treatment. LSU Medical School professor Paul Harch discovered peer-reviewed papers from China, where researchers there had been using hyperbaric chambers, HBOT, with stunning success. Between April and May, a group of NYU researchers reproduced that success by getting patients off ventilators and quickly recovering 18 of 20 ventilator cases using HBOT. Yale is currently conducting Phase 3 with stellar early results. There were many other promising treatments. Asian nations were using saline nasal lavages to great effect to reduce viral loads and transmission. McCullough discovered he could prophylax patients and drop viral load and prevent transmission with a variety of other oral nasal rinses and dilute virucidal agents, including povidone iodine, hydrogen peroxide, hypochlorite, and Listerine or mouthwash with cetylpyridinium chloride. Mass General's infectious disease maven Dr. Michael Callahan had seen hundreds of patients in Wuhan in January 2020 and assessed the impressive efficacy of Pepcid in over-the-counter indigestion medicine. The Japanese were already using prednisone, budesonide, and famotidine with extraordinary results. By July 1st, McCullough and his team had developed the first protocol based on signals of benefit and acceptable safety. They submitted the protocol to the American Journal of Medicine. That study, titled The Pathophysiologic Basis and Clinical Rationale for Early Ambulatory Treatment of COVID-19, quickly became the world's most downloaded paper to help doctors treat COVID-19. It is extraordinary that Dr. Fauci never published a single treatment protocol before that, says McCullough, and that America's doctor has never to date published anything on how to treat a COVID patient. It shocks the conscience that there is still no official protocol. Anyone who tries to publish a new treatment protocol will find themselves airtight blocked by the journals that are all under Fauci's control. The Chinese published their own early treatment protocol on March 3, 2020, using many of the same categories of prophylactic and early treatment drugs uncovered by McCullough. Chloroquine, a cousin of hydroxychloroquine, antibiotics, anti-inflammatories, antihistamines, a variety of steroids, and probiotics to stabilize and fortify the immune system, and apothecaries of traditional Chinese medicines, vitamins, and minerals, including a variety of compounds containing quercetin, zinc, and glutathione precursors. The Chinese made early treatment the central priority of their COVID strategy. They used intense and intrusive track-and-trace surveillance to identify and then immediately hospitalize and treat every COVID-infected Chinese. Early treatment helped the Chinese to end their pandemic by April 2020. We could have done the same, says McCullough. Though now he is often censored, the AMA still lists Dr. McCullough's study as the most frequently downloaded paper for 2020. The Association of American Physicians and Surgeons, AAPS, downloaded and turned McCullough's AMA article into its official treatment guide. AAPS Director Dr. Jeremy Snavely told me in August 2021 that the guide had 122,000 downloads. We figure it has been seen by over 1 million people. It's the only trusted guide. Our phone never stops ringing. Mostly the calls are from physicians and patients desperate for the help they cannot get from any HHS website. By autumn, frontline physicians had assembled a pharmacopoeia of repurposed drugs, all of which were effective against COVID. By that time, more than 200 studies supported treatment with hydroxychloroquine and 60 studies supported ivermectin. We combined these medicines with doxycycline, azithromycin to suppress infection, says McCullough. Another meta-analysis supported the use of prednisone and hydrocortisone and other widely available steroids to combat inflammation. Three studies supported the use of inhaled budesonide against COVID. An Oxford University study, published in February 2021, demonstrated that that treatment could reduce hospitalizations by 90% in low-risk patients. And a publication in April 2021 showed that recovery was faster for high-risk patients, too. Furthermore, a very large study supported colchicine as an anti-inflammatory. Finally, McCullough's growing array of physicians had observational data from late-stage treatment of hospitalized patients with full-dose aspirin and antithrombotics, including enoxaparin, apixaban, rivaroxaban, dabigatran, edoxaban, and full-dose anticoagulation with low molecular weight heparin for blood clots. We were able to show that doctors can work with 4 to 6 drugs in combination, supplemented by vitamins and nutraceuticals, including zinc, vitamins D and C, and quercetin. And they can guide patients at home, even the highest risk seniors, and avoid a dreaded outcome of hospitalization and death, said McCullough. Working with a large practice in the Plano-Frisco area north of Dallas, McCullough and his team administered this protocol to some 800 patients and demonstrated an 85% reduction in hospitalization and death. Another practice led by the legendary Dr. Vladimir Zelenko in Monroe, New York, showed similar astonishing results. Independent physicians unaffiliated with the government or the universities that are so dependent on Dr. Fauci's good favor, were discovering new COVID treatments by the day. Researchers treated 738 randomly selected Brazilian COVID-19 patients with another adjuvant, fluvoxamine, identified early in the pandemic for its potential to reduce cytokine storms. Another 733 received a placebo between January 20th and August 6th of 2021. The researchers tracked every patient receiving fluvoxamine during the trial for 28 days and found about a 30% reduction in events among those receiving fluvoxamine compared to those who did not. Like almost all the other remedies, it is cheap and proven safe by long use. Fluvoxamine costs about $4 per 10-day course. Fluvoxamine has been used since the 1990s, and its safety profile is well known. Hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin are not necessary nor sufficient on their own. There are plenty of molecules that treat COVID, says McCullough. Even if hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin had become so politicized that no one wanted to allow these drugs to be used, we could use other drugs, anti-inflammatories, antihistamines, as well as anticoagulants, and actually stop the illness and, again, treat it to reduce hospitalization and death. When the pandemic started, most of the other medical practices in the Detroit area shut down, Dr. David Brownstein told me. I had a meeting with my staff and my 6 partners. I told them, we are going to stay open and treat COVID. They wanted to know how. I said, we've been treating viral diseases here for 25 years. COVID can't be any different. In all that time, our office has never lost a single patient to flu or flu-like illness. We treated people in their cars with oral vitamins A, C, and D, and iodine. We administered IV solution outside all winter with IV hydrogen peroxide and vitamin C. We'd have them put their butts out the car window and shot them up with intramuscular ozone. We nebulized them with hydrogen peroxide and Lugol's iodine. We only rarely used ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine. We treated 715 patients and had 10 hospitalizations and no deaths. Early treatment was the key. We weren't allowed to talk about it. The whole medical establishment was trying to shut down early treatment and silence all the doctors who talked about successes. A whole generation of doctors just stopped practicing medicine. When we talked about it, the whole cartel came for us. I've been in litigation with the medical board for a year. When we posted videos from some of our recovered patients, they went viral. One of the videos had 1 million views. FTC filed a motion against us, and we had to take everything down. In July 2020, Brownstein and his 7 colleagues published a peer-reviewed article describing their stellar success with early treatment. FTC sent him a letter warning him to take it down. No one wanted Americans to know that you didn't have to die from COVID. It's 100% treatable, says Dr. Brownstein. We proved it. No one had to die. Meanwhile, adds Dr. Brownstein, we've seen lots of really bad vaccine side effects in our patients. We've had 7 strokes, some ending in severe paralysis. We had 3 cases of pulmonary embolism, 2 blood clots, 2 cases of Graves' disease, and 1 death. Repurposed medicines, the record shows, could also have drastically reduced death among hospitalized patients. One of Dr. Corey's co-founders of FLCCC, Houston Memorial Medical Center's chief medical officer, Dr. Joe Varone, worked 400 days in a row, seeing between 20 to 30 patients a day. Using ivermectin and a cocktail of anti-inflammatories, steroids, and anticoagulants since spring 2020, Dr. Varone lowered hospital mortality among ICU COVID patients to about 4.1%, compared to well over 23% nationally. Even in the ICUs, where patients were coming in undertreated, we were able to dramatically reduce mortality, says Dr. Corey. Almost anything you do in the nursing homes, basically any combination of the various components of these protocols, reduces mortalities by at least 60%, McCullough told me. A 2021 paper in Medical Hypotheses supports McCullough's claim. That study, by 12 physician co-authors, shows that diverse combinations of many of these and similar medications dramatically lower death rates in a variety of nursing homes. The study concludes that even the most modest early medical therapy combinations were associated with 60% reductions in mortality. Says Dr. McCullough, therapeutic nihilism was the real killer of America's seniors. McCullough's findings may be conservative. Early in the pandemic, 2 Spanish nursing homes simultaneously experimented with early treatment with cheap, available repurposed drugs and achieved 100% survival among infected residents and staff. Between March and April 2020, COVID-19 struck 2 elder care facilities in Yepes, Toledo, Spain. The mean age of residents in those locations was 85, and 48% were over 80 years old. Within 3 months, 100% of the residents at both locations had caught the virus. By the end of June, 100% of residents and half the workers were seropositive for COVID, meaning they had endured infection and recovered. None of them went to the hospital, and none died. None had adverse drug effects. Local doctors rapidly discovered early treatment with the same sort of remedies that McCullough was championing: antihistamines, steroids, antibiotics, anti-inflammatories, aspirin, nasal washes, bronchodilators, and blood thinners. In pooled data, 28% of the residents in similar nursing homes in the same region over the same time period died. That study supports the experience of frontline physicians that cheap, available, repurposed drugs can easily prevent hospitalizations and deaths. Dr. McCullough and 57 colleagues published a second study in December of 2020 in a dedicated issue of Reviews in Cardiovascular Medicine. The article, Multifaceted, Highly Targeted Sequential Multidrug Treatment of Early Ambulatory High-Risk SARS-CoV-2 Infection, COVID-19, described a marvelous breadth of effective drugs that these physicians had by then developed.